All right, so first, were there things in what we've done so far that people didn't feel they understood and wanted more discussion of before we go on to the next chapter? Yes, no, maybe. All right, so let me do my one-slide review of last week, which is decision theory. You look at the structure of the problem in terms of choices, random events with probability and payoffs. You diagram it with a box for a choice, a circle for random, lines between them, probabilities and payoffs, and you solve it right to left by evaluating circles at each square where you have choices. You lop off the ones you wouldn't make, and you just keep going until you're left with your one best choice. So it's really sort of a formal way of doing something we all do all the time, which is evaluating decisions to make. Game theory is, I think, a more interesting and much more difficult problem, that it involves strategic behavior where the outcome depends not on just my choices but on our choices. Therefore, what I ought to do depends on what you're going to do, and what you're going to do depends on what I'm going to do, and I can't think of your behavior as just random because you yourself are strategically behaving against me. And that describes, among other things, much of economics, politics, and diplomacy. And if we had a general solution, if there was some way in which any strategic situation could be somehow put into a standard form and solved, and boom, that's what happens, that would be extraordinarily useful for making sense of those subjects. Unfortunately, we don't. The Theory of Games and Economic Behavior by von Neumann is, I think, the first book on the subject. I think there had been journal articles before by von Neumann and Morgenstern, actually. And it was an attempt at a head-on assault on this problem, and it made great progress for about two chapters, during which it in fact solved one piece of the problem in some sense, and it then bogged down thereafter, so that if you read it you have the experience of watching an extraordinarily intelligent person tackling an even more extraordinarily difficult problem. There are a number of stories about von Neumann. He's sort of one of my heroes, I guess. One of them was a comment by a physicist who had a Nobel Prize to the effect that there are two kinds of people in the world, Johnny von Neumann and the rest of us. And the other was the comment by Enrico Fermi, another very famous physicist. After he met von Neumann, he turned to one of his colleagues and he said, "You know, that man is cleverer than I am, just as I'm cleverer than you are." Fermi must have been an interesting character. Anyway. So it's a neat book, and I recommend it if you have time and want the intellectual exercise, but one of the conclusions I carried away from it was that problems that stumped Johnny von Neumann were at the bottom of my list of things to work on. So a lot of what we do involves optimizing against nature. You're saying, what should I do given the world out there? What's the probability of rain? Should I take an umbrella? What crops should I plant given what we know about the weather, so forth and so on. And there is a natural human tendency to personify nature. And this is sometimes put as Finagle's law: if something can go wrong, it will, or the perversity of inanimate objects. And that's how we feel, but we know it really isn't true. We know that, in fact, the weather does not wait to see whether we've taken an umbrella before it decides whether to rain. And similarly for other such things. For one thing, we know that we took an umbrella and our neighbor didn't, and therefore when it rained, it got it wrong for one of us. So, on the other hand, in interacting with human beings in some contexts, we're perfectly correct to think that if something can go wrong, it will, because the other human being is trying to make it go wrong. So if you consider what's referred to in game theory as a zero-sum game, which means a game where anything I win, you lose, where the sum of our winnings is zero, so if I gain $10, you lose $10. In that context, you are doing your very best to hurt me. You are trying to minimize the amount I win, because minimizing the amount I win maximizes the amount you win. Not all games are zero-sum, but some of them are. Consider a non-zero-sum, sometimes called non-fixed sum, because the logic would really be the same if we got paid $10 for playing the game, but then anything other than that, a dollar for me was a loss for you. And the one I've discussed before is what economists call bilateral monopoly. My apple is worth nothing to me, a dollar to you, and no one else is in the game. And it's bilateral monopoly because I'm a monopoly seller, but you're a monopoly buyer. I'm the only seller, you're the only buyer. Monopoly buyers are called monopsonies in economics. If I sell you the apple, what's the sum of our gains? How much better off are we if I sell you the apple? $1, right? However divided. If bargaining breaks down, if I demand that you pay 90 cents and you refuse, what's the sum of our gains? Zero. So that's why it's not a fixed sum game. All right? It's a very, very, very simple non-fixed sum game and therefore useful for thinking about the general issues. So therefore, we simultaneously are cooperating and conflicting. We're cooperating in that we have a common interest in getting a deal, and we have a conflict in that I want the price to be as high as possible and you as low as possible. And if you think about it, the world is full of games which have that pattern. If you think about international diplomacy, all right, both the Israelis and Hamas would like a situation in which they aren't shooting each other on any very large scale. And it may well be, I don't know, that there are terms which Israel would like that Hamas would prefer to continued violence. And there are other much more pro-Hamas terms that Hamas would like but Israel would prefer to continued violence. And so each of them is on the one hand trying to push the outcome in their direction, but on the other hand trying to avoid the mutually undesirable one of continuing to shoot up the Gaza Strip. And again, part of the paradox is if you know I'm going to hold out for a high price, you ought to pay it. But if I know you're going to hold out for a low price, I ought to accept it. So both of us. And that means that we both have an incentive to bluff. We both have an incentive to try to tie our hands. I can say this apple is, I won't sell it for less than 90 cents. And furthermore, I just announced to all my friends that if I gave in and sold it for 90 cents, that would prove I was an absolute wimp and none of them should respect me again. And by announcing that to my friends, I made it very costly for me to accept your offer of 80 cents, and therefore you now know you're going to have to pay me 90 cents. That would be a simple example of a commitment strategy. So, two-player fixed sum, two-player variable sum, many-player game. Many-player game, each player is trying to maximize his returns, they're all choosing moves. And now we've got some new elements that you didn't have before, and one of them is coalitions. Suppose we have a many-player game, which for all of us put together is fixed sum, say zero-sum, in which anything that I win, someone has lost. It is still a non-fixed sum game for him and me, because him and the two of us can try to ally against the other players, and the two of us could gain at your loss. So therefore, in one sense, it's fixed sum for the whole group, but for each sub-coalition within it, they might end up with net gains or net losses. And therefore, if you tried to analyze a many-player game, which is roughly where von Neumann ran into trouble, you have three different games. One of them is coalition forming. I would like to get together with him, but he, in order to get better terms from me, tries to get together with her, or at least threatens to, and while we're doing that, the three of you people are forming a coalition that you think can beat all of us, and so forth and so on. If you think about alliances and international diplomacy, for example. Then, if you have coalitions, imagine the simplest case where there's a coalition of the three of us, and then a coalition of everybody else. We're now down to a two-player game, as it were, our coalition playing against their coalition. But embedded in that is yet another many-player game, namely within our coalition dividing up the games. I heard a workshop paper years ago at Chicago in the economics department on the question of auctions. And the person who delivered the paper actually had experience in the auction industry, which is what made it interesting. Because there's all this mathematics of different ways of doing auctions. And by his account, almost all of it is wrong. Because real auctions are rigged. That in real auctions, what typically happens is you've got some particular item which only three people among the bidders are interested in. And assuming they can figure it out, those three people get together. And they say, look, there's no point driving up the price of this item. So what we're going to do is that one of us will bid for all three. And then next stage, we'll have to decide who gets the item at what price. But initially, one of us bids, the other two stay out. And so the result is that they get the item for $10,000 when they would have bid it up to $50,000 if they were bidding against each other. auction is over, everything is sold, they go out, the three people remain behind because they've prudently reserved the auction room for another hour. And they now have a second auction. This one is among the three of them to decide who gets the item and how much the other two, and how much he pays the other two. And by his account, you sometimes had a third level. If it was more than three, it was 15. Among the 15, there might be a coalition who tried not to bid enough and then had a third auction among themselves. Furthermore, to add even further complication, one of the reasons, by his account, that real auctioneers make a lot of money if they're good at it, is that one of the things real auctioneers do is see bids that aren't there. So if you're the auctioneer, and you are pretty sure that that person is bidding for three people who value it at $50,000, and the bidding has stopped at $10,000, you look around the room and look at an imaginary person behind the real bidder, and you say, oh, $11,000? And then, if you've guessed right, the real bidder says $12,000, $13,000 over there, and if the auctioneer is good, he stops his fake bids just a little bit before the actual bidder stops his real bids. And if not, he's got a problem because the good now hasn't sold because he sold it in effect to himself. So anyway, it was interesting seeing a description of this sort of strategic behavior going on in a real world setting, looking very, very different from what the standard mathematics of auctions, which normally assumes no cooperation, looks like. All right. So those are three categories of games: two-player fixed sum, two-player variable sum, and many-player. What we then need, if we want to solve games, we would like to have some way of describing a game, something better than here is a rule book for this particular game. We'd like to have some way in which we can put chess, checkers, bridge, poker, union bargaining, everything else, into a common form, or at least a small number of standardized forms to represent many games. We have to have a definition of what we mean by a solution, which is not an easy question, and then we have to have a way of finding it. So what might a solution to a game mean? If you think just conceptually, if I say, here's a game, here's poker, what would it mean to solve poker?
Maximize your own.
Given what about the other players?
Given they're playing as well as they can, or I don't know.
And what does their playing as well as they can mean?
Well, because you can, given the other players, like, you can decide your own players often in poker, so...
Or you can decide what?
You can decide the table you sit at in poker.
Yes.
So, in a real-world situation, you're like, oh, it's a bunch of sharks, you know, fuck that table, I'm just going to go with the fish and take all their money. You know, like, these people are they're very inexperienced.
But that also suggests that the solution to how to play at those two different tables would be different.
Yeah.
So you might, ideally, you might have a solution concept which covered all of them, where somehow one of the factors of the game was the players. I'm not sure anybody's done that. What von Neumann did for the two-player one was essentially the solution for the sharks. What he asked was the question of, in some sense, what is the perfect way to play against a perfect player? And then we have to, even that is hard to define, but it at least eliminates stealing candy from babies, which is bridge players' equivalent of fish. And we're going to be looking at, I think, only two different ways in which you could describe games. And one of them works, it turns out, for all games, and one of which works for some games. And the first one we're going to use, because we've already spent a week doing it, is a decision tree. And we will see how the approach we used there can be applied to not decision theory, but game theory. So let's take a look at a decision problem we had before, where we had a basketball player, if I remember anyway, a sports star of some sort, and possible contracts we could offer him. A foolish set of contracts, but we're stuck with them for this particular problem. So if the decision tree, it looks like what we had before, except that now some choices are made by one person and some by another. And in the one I'm doing, there are only two players, and one of them is blue and one of them is black in order to distinguish them on the tree. There may also be random elements. And it turns out that there is indeed an interesting solution concept for this, for games that can be looked at this way, though with limitations, and it's one which is closely related to what we've just been doing. So let's take a look at the basketball player. And the team, turn out the lights too. The team is black, and the player is blue, maybe black and blue after playing. I want to look, again, we want to go from right to left, so I'm going to start out by looking at the rightmost edge. And I'm just going to look at the blue boxes. Obviously, they're going to be similar boxes up at 1 and 3, but I'm not going to get them onto the slide. So if we look at the box up here, where I need a laser pointer, what do we see? We see that his options are to play or not to play, and that if he doesn't play, he receives $6 million. And if he does play, he receives $6 million, but also has, since this is the case where he's in poor condition, he also has the $2 million cost of the pain of playing, which he evaluates at $2 million. So given that, what choice does he make?
He doesn't play.
He doesn't play, obviously. So therefore, we could, and I haven't animated this slide, we could simply lob off this branch and put at this branch the results from there, namely $0 to them, $6 million to him. We then could do the same thing on those two, and we could then go back here and find the value of that. Similarly, down on the lower one, the lower box, if he doesn't play, he gets $0. If he does play, he gets $8 million after allowing for the $2 million cost of the pain to him. So that times three, he plays. So we can lop off the doesn't play branch and run it back. All right. So you see how we could do the same thing we were doing before, except this time we have two players. And this time, the black player says, I can predict what blue player will do in his final choice. He'll make his optimal choice. I can therefore make the choice before that, knowing he's going to do that. Make sense so far? Yes? No? All right. Any of you parents currently? All right. Well, some of you probably will be. And you will be playing this game with your children. Not this one, but games that can be described with this structure. And you will discover that subgame perfect equilibrium is imperfect. That it is not, in fact, a complete description of the situation due to a feature of the problem which game theory can and ought to take account of. So I want to now consider the tantrum game. And this is the situation where you are having friends over for a dinner party, and your small child enjoys dinner parties, enjoys especially the desserts at the end, but also being paid attention to by grown-ups because he or she is a cute kid, and it is well past the kid's bedtime. And you tell your child, you must go to bed now. And your child says, no. And you say, well, I'm going to pick you up and carry you up to your bedroom. And she says, I'll scream. And you evaluate costs and benefits, where you will observe that your choice is either put the child to bed or not put the child to bed. And the child's choice is either to throw a tantrum or not to throw a tantrum. And the cost to you of putting the child to bed and having the child throw a tantrum and embarrassing yourself in front of all the guests and all of the other problems associated with is a cost of 10, minus 10. The child doesn't actually enjoy throwing a tantrum either and is going to bed in this case anyway, so isn't getting what she wants, so the cost to her is minus 10 as well. Whereas given that you're putting her to bed, not only would you be much happier if she goes quietly to bed like the good little girl that of course she is, that's plus 10 for you, but she in fact, although unhappy at having to go to bed and miss the party, would be less unhappy if she doesn't go through all of the unpleasantness of throwing a tantrum. So therefore, she's minus 5. If you don't put her to bed, now throwing a tantrum, 0 for her, plus 10 for not tantrum, minus 15 on the tantrum, minus 5 on the not tantrum, because you really didn't want to have her around your dinner party and getting tired and more cranky as the evening went on. Right? So let's try subgame perfect equilibrium, which is the approach we just used on the previous slide. Assuming you put her to bed, according to subgame perfect equilibrium, what does she do?
Doesn't
doesn't throw a tantrum. That's only minus 5 versus minus 10. Whereas she also doesn't throw a tantrum if you don't put her to bed. Well, that makes life very simple. You say to yourself, since she's not going to throw a tantrum, obviously I ought to put her to bed. That gives me a plus 10 instead of a minus 5. All right? Is it clear why that's what subgame perfect equilibrium tells you? It tells you that once you've made the choice to put her to bed, it's not in her interest to throw the tantrum, so she won't. And let me suggest that you not take this as useful advice on how to interact with your children, because it's a bad prediction. And it's a bad prediction not because your child is irrational, but because your child is rational. Because your child knows, and her genes know as well, she is, after all, designed to get her way, because she evolved in an environment where it's important to a child to divert resources from other children to herself, and from other things to herself, if she was going to survive. We nowadays live in a society where children don't starve to death, but that wasn't the case through most of history, no, most of prehistory, really. And she knows she's in a repeated game. And she knows, or some part of her knows, that the benefit of throwing a tantrum when you insist on putting her to bed is that maybe next time she'll get to stay up and enjoy the evening. All right? So she has committed herself in some fashion to throw the tantrum if you don't do what she wants. If you know that she is committed to that, you then realize that she's going to throw the tantrum to put her to bed, and you're better off having her stay up and not throw a tantrum than having her put to bed and throw a tantrum, so you give in and the child gets what she wants, which happens more commonly than parents would like to believe in many different games of this sort. Very easy for non-parents to say you should never give in, not so easy in the real world, because the arguments that tell the parents you should never give in also tell the child she shouldn't give in. So what's one way of putting this is that the subgame perfect equilibrium assumes that there are no commitment strategies. All right, commitment strategy doesn't have to be a repeated game. Suppose it was only going to happen once. But suppose the child has got an emotional switch inside her that she can sort of persuade herself, I deserve to be able to stay up and see and enjoy this party. And if daddy is so mean as to put me to bed when there's a perfectly fun party going on in the living room downstairs, I ought to scream and jump and punch him and throw a tantrum and so forth. If the child can do that, and if the parent can tell the child has done that by the signals by which you read other people's emotional state, then the father, the parent, is going to back down. So even in a non-repeated game, if the child has ways of committing herself, then that the existence of those commitment strategies means that the subgame perfect equilibrium result can't be expected to happen. And you have to instead think of the sort of further game of what ways do you have of committing yourself, given that you've committed yourself in a certain way, how will the other person behave? All right. So that's sort of my explanation and critique of subgame perfect equilibrium, which has been a hot topic for the last 15 years or so in law and econ, or maybe it cooled off 5 years ago and I didn't notice, but at least when I left Chicago, it was still what the game theory type people thought was great. And they were using it for things like bankruptcy analysis, where you imagine there are several steps, and the last step people do what's in their interest, and the step before that you know they're going to do what's in their interest, so you can decide that way, and so forth. And I'm certainly not suggesting it's a useless approach. There are sick contexts where commitment strategies aren't relevant, but you have to realize that it has that limitation. So if we go back to the previous case, one of the things we might like to ask is, what result would the basketball player like to see? And if the result he would like to see, I'm not sure in this particular case there's any conflict, but if the result he would like to see is a result that doesn't happen because the other player can predict, because the team can predict what he'll do, he might want to commit himself to do something different under those circumstances so as to get a better contract out of it. All right. Question? No question? So, method one for describing many games, any game you can think of as consecutive decisions, is a decision tree. And that game may give you a solution as long as you don't have commitment strategies. And part of the reason why commitment strategies mess it up, of course, is that they are in a sense simultaneous. That in the decision game we showed, I make my move, then you make move, then I make my move, then you make. But there are lots of cases where I make my move not knowing what you've done, you make your move not knowing what I've done, and yet the outcome will depend on both, So let's consider another method, which it turns out, surprisingly enough, covers every possible two-player game. In fact, I think every possible n-player game, I think, is a correct statement, despite the fact the book thinks it doesn't. And that's the strategy matrix. And we'll start out with a game we discussed before. It's a nice, simple game that many of us have played as children called Scissors, Paper, Stone. And the rules are scissors cuts paper, stone breaks scissors, paper covers stone.